My name is David Livingstone, independent researcher, been at it for 30 years. I've written 5 books. My focus really has been on the history of the occult. The reason for that is because there's an important side of history which has been largely ignored by mainstream historians. And it's an important, very crucial piece of the puzzle that it's pretty much impossible to understand most of the currents of history without exploring the influence of the occult. So I just finished my most recent book, which is Ordo ab Chao, which of course is Latin for Order of Chaos. It's basically a dictum from the Scottish Rite Freemasonry, and effectively explains, you know, the what their MO is, with how what they're trying to bring about. It's a book that basically, as I've summarized, I would say that you know, all my previous 4 other books combined wouldn't amount to about 15% of this recent book. There's a lot of findings that I, you know, I thought I'd a lot of subjects I thought I'd studied thoroughly, and there's a lot new that I discovered. One of the most important sources that I used that really provided me most of the clues that led me to research that led me to research more deeply and expand on was Russ Bellant's Old Nazis. I think it's called Old Nazis and Their New Right or something like that. Old Right and Old Nazis and something like that. I can't remember the exact title, but it's an amazing book. You know, the what's a big topic that's been ignored, particularly by conspiracy researchers, and this in fact is a point that I explore in my book, is that the myth of the 20th century has been that a conspiracy is communist in intent. And this, what I've uncovered, is that you know, the purveyors of conspiracy information, or disinformers, we can say, it has been their strategy to try to present the conspiracy as communist or left wing, when in actuality it's actually fascist. And so Russ Bellant's book is really essential reading. You know, it's not a fringy kind of conspiracy book. I wouldn't say it's a mainstream book, but it's one of those rare few books that is done by a talented researcher and exposes a lot of details. And that book, in particular, it exposes the core of the fascist trends in the United States, but also covers the role of Ukraine.
Well, look, it's certainly not apparent to me that this is a communist conspiracy at all. The hostile takeover bid for the United Nations, which happened a couple of years ago, and a successful one too. That is to say, the partnership agreement between the World Economic Forum and the UN, which was running out of money, whilst basically the UN, the World Economic Forum, could print as much as it wanted. That is a gathering of big corporations. This is private companies.
That's
This
it.
is not some kind of state
No.
organized program or plan, as the old communist countries used to have at all. So if you try and take a step back from much of this, this whole idea of of this being a communist conspiracy does seem absurd. But look, you know, you writing about the occult, for most people, this is just kooky stuff. Maybe the stuff of some, you know, pretty good novels like Dennis Wheatley's, for example, The Devil Rides Out, which is an occult novel, which was very successful in the 1970s. And translated into pretty much every language on the planet. But this is the stuff of fiction, not for historians, David.
No, sorry. So, what's your question? What
Well,
was it?
what I'm saying
It's a
is the occult is a kooky subject. It's not
Yes,
for,
it
you
is.
know, real historians.
Well, that's the reality is that's changing. So, I mean, it's changing somewhat. It's sort of being co-opted over the last, I don't know what it is, maybe 20 or 30 years. There's been a huge shift. There was a few sort of breakthrough scholar academic efforts to explore the occult. Probably one of the more famous ones would be Frances Yates, who studied the Rosicrucian movement, and so she really brought a lot of academic respectability to that kind of study, because the way that she approached it was really really top notch. So, you know, more recently, particularly like the last 10 or 20 years, you've seen a growing number of scholars starting, and I think there's a department, I'm not sure which university, I think it's in Holland. There's actually a department now devoted to the study of, you know, esoterics or whatever they want to call it. So there's also, you know, one of the sources that I use the most for my books is Brill, the Brill publisher out of Leiden in the Netherlands. And it's amazing the quality of scholarship that is coming out of there, and most of it devoted to the history of the occult. It tends to whitewash things quite a bit. You know, they avoid any kind of conspiratorial interpretations, but they do expose quite a bit, and the level of detail is really phenomenal. So, you know, I mean, it's a reality that it's been, you know, poo-pooed as sort of nonsense, that's not changing much, but I mean, it's part of the attempt, just a conspiracy theory in general, to try to fight against, you know, having this stuff exposed, is by trying to ridicule it. But I mean,
In the UK, we had in the 1980s a publication of a book called The Brotherhood, which was looking at the highly political project of the Freemasons, which was to do with infiltration of the police, particularly the Metropolitan Police in London, links back to the Jack the Ripper murders. There was also a tremendously detailed work done on the Masons' attempts to infiltrate the civil service, you know, specific lodges. This is by Stephen Knight. And that work was then carried on with his book was The Brotherhood, and he died just about a year or so after it was published. Right. Yeah. But Martin Short, the TV journalist, he picked up on Stephen's work, and he published a book which was about three times as thick called Inside the Brotherhood, which was really looking at much of the correspondence that came into Stephen Knight, that obviously because he was dead, he couldn't publish his sequel. So Martin Short did that job. And I think this definitely made a difference in the 1980s here in the UK in exposing secret societies as an extremely powerful tool in politics, David.
Yeah.
And obviously that has kind of disappeared. We also had a BBC television series called Secret Society, which was done by Duncan Campbell, who is one of the foremost technology and data protection investigative journalists in the world, and he's still around, Duncan Campbell. But that was also the one of the reasons why the Director General of the BBC was sacked under the orders of Victor Rothschild and Marmaduke Hussey, who's the he was the husband of the Queen's Lady in Waiting, and so the BBC was very much punished for producing this. I think it was a 6 or 8 part series on secret societies in British politics, in the Parliament. So there's definitely something out there which was being looked at very closely in the 1980s as Thatcher and Reagan were privatizing, selling everything off. There was a very strong journalistic movement in London saying, hang on a minute, this is there's something going on here. We believe secret societies are behind it. So in a way, you know, I think, you know, you looking at the occult is something that many journalists, writers, historians really should pay more attention to this, because it is something that's definitely real. It's not a, it's a very easy to ridicule. But anyway, look, you were talking there about modern Nazis. And of course, we like to think that 1945 was the end of all of that, David. And I think you've proved pretty conclusively that it wasn't.
Definitely not. No. Yeah, it's to a shocking extent. So, you know, there's so much of that story. It's so the survival is so extensive, and it's basically why, you know, the conspiracy has remained fascist ever since. That's how it extends to the Ukraine, because that's how you get there was a strong component or partners in this fascist conspiracy, which remain or were created in the Ukraine. and collaborated with the CIA for most of the Cold War. And so it's basically sort of, you know, branches of that same fascist movement in Ukraine that continued to collaborate with the CIA and NATO to try to destabilize Russia. And then if you want to carry it even forward to more recent times, it's really when you get, because there's sort of the more conventional neo-Nazis that were collaborating with the CIA throughout the Cold War. But, you know, parallel to that, there was a much more sort of occult-oriented fascist side. Now, not to say that the two were separate, but, you know, they kind of almost had two fronts. And so that more underlying occult side is what has survived, particularly in what's called the Azov Battalion, which is really the main arm of the neo-Nazi and neo-Nazi infiltration that is participating in the conflict in Ukraine. So, you know, we're talking about the Black Sun. So, you know, the fact that they used the Black Sun is a classic example of this, you know, parallel channel of occult neo-Nazism.
The idea seems to be, and with much occultism, and particularly with the Freemasons, we know this for a fact, is that they prefer to use symbols and signs rather than to spell things out, David. So what sort of symbols and signs should we be looking for? You just talked about the Black Sun. Can you talk about what that is and its origin?
Yeah, so the Black Sun is basically, it's an occult symbol, and it's like a... It's pretty, it's a symbol that's found in the Wewelsburg castle that the SS used for their rituals. What's interesting is that Michael Aquino, he also held, founder of the Temple of Set, he also held a ritual there as well too. And so effectively, you know, the Black Sun traditionally has always been equated with Saturn. So in the occult, you have these sort of polar opposites. You have the sun, the brighter sun that shines in the sky, and then you have the what's called sort of the nocturnal sun that's traditionally, going back thousands of years, has always been worshipped as the darker, you know, reverse aspect of the sun that most satanic rituals are offered to. So this is actually, you know, a big portion that I cover in my book, and you can see how the worship of Saturn, that was Moloch in the Bible, that the Israelites used to practice human sacrifice, and this is how it evolved into the rituals of Saturnalia from the Babylonian festivals, as a 12-day festival, which evolved in Saturnalia, which evolved in Christmas, which is why basically, to make, you know, a big tangent, but Santa is Satan, effectively. So basically, this is the cult basis of Saturn. So the idea became of the Black Sun became popularized. That's why there's a book devoted to it called Black Sun. I can't remember the subtitle, by Nicholas Goodrich Clark, who's kind of the more respected scholar of occult Nazism. He's quite the apologist, but still, I mean, he reveals quite a bit, especially in the book Black Sun. So there's a whole trend of occult Nazism that emerged after World War II. You have some particularly important characters, like probably the two most important that come to my mind would be Savitri Devi, or Devi, and Miguel Serrano. Miguel Serrano is a fascinating guy. He's a guy from Chile, so he's connected to a whole sort of what's called Operation Condor of the CIA's collaboration with the Nazis in Argentina and Chile, which collects Colonia Dignidad, which is a very bizarre Nazi colony in Chile that also collaborated with, you know, tortures and disappearances with the Nazis. And Savitri Devi was an occult. Basically, it's an occult adaptation of effectively the worship of Hitler merged with various occult concepts. They have all kinds of bizarre ideas, like Serrano believed that, you know, Hitler survived, and they believe that he lived in a base in Antarctica, and that the Nazis were flying saucers out of the hollow earth. Just to give you a sample of how bizarre these legends and beliefs become. So that's basically, you know, a portion of the basis of this occult Nazism that developed. And I said most of these groups, they adopted the the black sun as a recurring symbol. So a very important organization behind all of this is what's called the Order of the Nine Angles. And this is founded by a guy named David Myatt, I think back in the 70s. And really curious character. What's rare about this group in particular is that they openly advocated for human sacrifice. And they were openly satanic and Nazi at the same time. And they also advanced a particular, I guess you could say, political ideology known as accelerationism. And accelerationism was developed by a guy named David Lind. And I won't go into the details there, but basically accelerationism is the belief that, because what's common about all Luciferian and satanic groups is that the problem is that people think of them as being, you know, in a sense, sort of atheistic. And yes, they are anti-religious, but they are effectively modern Gnostics. So they hold to the same history as Christians, Jews, or Muslims, except, of course, they see themselves as the antagonists. So the entire history that's presented in the Bible is very much at the core of their outlook in the world, except that they want to bring about the reverse. So what's really important for them is the end times. You know, even so much as the, how they're described in the book of Revelation. But what most of these Luciferian or satanic groups are trying to do is they're trying to accelerate the end times. So this goes back to the concept of Ordo Ab Cao, that if chaos is supposed to precede the coming of the Messiah, then what they need to do is they need to accelerate and aggravate or aggravate the chaos to help accelerate his arrival. So,
David, but I mean, most of us, we think, well, no one wants war. And yet you've just described, and in fact, I think in a way it's quite clever of these groups to come out with this stuff about Hitler in Antarctica and spaceships flying out of a hollow earth, because any group that's putting out ideas like that is less likely to be treated in any way seriously. And this could almost be a kind of cover for their, you know, what is actually a very nefarious activity. But, you know, this goes against human nature completely, doesn't it? It's actually a complete reversal because none of us want wars, at least most of us don't. We realize that this is a terrible, destructive part of human nature. It's something that we've got to nix from the past. We've got to stop it. And yet these people, to them, it's almost a religion to get one started.
It is. I mean, you know, it's important to understand that, you know, Satanism is, the thing is that, so Satanism is the glorification of evil. And evil is not something that Satanists invented, right? Evil basically is a tendency in the human beings. It's a tendency to reject, it's pessimism, right? It's the tendency to reject the optimism that, you know, there's a potential for good. In not only in human beings, but all of humanity.
But so, I mean, hang on, David. Sorry to keep interrupting, but also I think it's certainly in my experience, there are people out there who are basically hooked on power. They just want power. It's not, I mean, and even they may have more money than they could ever spend, you know, that they could buy 100 houses, 1,000 yachts, but they use that money to gain power, and it's power over others, which is like a drug to them.
Yes. So it's important to understand to what extent how they will use that, to what they will resort to achieve that power. And so this is really, really comes down to, this is why, you know, it's important that Edvard Munch's The Scream is considered to convey Nietzsche's God is Dead. Right. So it's basically the shock, the total horror of facing what they think is the reality, that there is no truth, there is no meaning to life. And so for them, the way they look at it is that they have the courage to face it. And instead of inventing ideas of, you know, gods and morality, they face the fact that it's hopeless for us out here, and there is no such thing as morality. And all that's left is, you know, what Nietzsche called the triumph of the will. So
isn't that a sort of nihilism?
Of course. Yes, exactly. So that's why Nietzsche came up. He had what he would characterize as negative nihilism, which is sort of more pessimistic and gloomy the sort of gloomy outlook from the recognition that God is dead. And then the positive nihilism is sort of you take hold of it, is that you recognize that, okay, sure, so there's no meaning to life, but there's a positive way you can look at it. You become creative and create, you become your own God. Like you can become God, right? This is what the Übermensch is basically the one who seizes, who's able to overcome the gloom of nihilism and to become an active creator of his own divinity or his own rules.
Yeah, that's just like a kind of cult around specific individuals. Now, of course, that can be to do with their massive wealth, maybe somebody like Bill Gates. But then if you go back to the 1930s and 40s, Hitler was being put forward very much as a man god. You know, he's saying, well, all the religions and all of the civil society has failed us, but this man is going to sort things out.
Yeah. So that's why it's, you know, the relationship between Nietzsche and Hitler is very close, right? I mean, Nietzsche was Hitler's hero, because that was the whole idea, is of man creating himself as a god by create, you know, taking God's place and you know, ruling humanity and basically making things up as he goes.
Hitler was kind of propelled into power by powerful people himself. Anyway, look, let's just bring this back to today, because we've had this quite surprising for many invasion of Ukraine by the Russians, who see their own existence threatened by the increasing militarization just 300 miles from Moscow. And they have a very genuine, I think, certainly in the Russian Duma, concern that rather than this Ukraine becoming a neutral country, there are more and more weapons being poured in there by the NATO countries, particularly things like anti-tank weapons, anti-aircraft, you know, something that they can use to shoot down Russian jets. And the Russians have basically just had enough. And so anyway, what do you make of this? Because we have a very important figure, which we don't get to see much of. And that's the woman I noticed in your article about this. Mm-hmm. There's an absolutely horrible photograph of her, Victoria Nuland, who is, I believe, the Assistant Secretary of State these days. But she is the woman who was behind the Maidan coup back in 2014, where the European Union and the United States pretty much seized control in a military coup. There was a killings of many of even the riot police. This is basically killing of your own demonstrators, making it look as if the Russian side had done it, but it wasn't. Anyway, who is this figure, Victoria Nuland, and what part has she played in this?
Yeah, so she's the architect. So basically, it's exactly like you said, it's the squabble between NATO and Russia. So, you know, you probably know the stories that when Germany wasn't a part of NATO, they and the Soviet Union collapsed, they made a deal with Gorbachev. They traded that. It'll say, okay, you know, let us absorb Germany into NATO, but we promise we're not going to move another inch. And so, of course, the Americans reneged on that promise. They denied that they've ever made it, even though there's a trail of documentation that proves that they did. And so it's put Russia in a very tough spot. And this is not to excuse Russia at all. You know, I really don't understand exactly what's happening, but it just means that the story is a lot murkier than the media is making it out to be. So, so one of the main, I guess, you know, in more recent times, so obviously the NATO has been moving steadily into former Soviet territory, and so Ukraine has been an important front in that movement. And Victoria Nuland is the key architect in the last decade and a half of those efforts. And so what's interesting is that her husband is Robert Kagan, I think, who's another leading neocon. He's also a member of PNAC, which is the Project for New American Century, which called for New Pearl Harbor just before 9/11. So a lot of people connect them to the orchestration of that event. She effectively what she did is that she teamed up with the far right in the Ukraine. This is despite the fact that she's Jewish. The the Ukrainian fascists are basically inheritors of Stepan Bandera, who gave birth to the fascist movement in Ukraine beginning in World War II, when he aligned himself with the Nazis and was implicated in various pogroms against the Jews, and then continued with his collaborators to work with the CIA throughout the Cold War. In fact, right after World War II, he started working with Aldo Scorzini. So when we talked about the Fascist International and survival of fascism, nearly there's two important ex-Nazis who were at the core of it all, and that was Reinhard Gehlen, who set up the Gehlen Org that collaborated closely with the CIA, and Aldo Scorzini. Aldo Scorzini was basically sent everywhere, worked in Spain, worked in South America, most importantly.
He went to Italy, and he managed to kidnap Mussolini, or rescue Mussolini, yes, who was imprisoned. Scorsese was a sort of a kind of swashbuckling Nazi, if it's possible to describe such a thing. I mean, he was the guy that would carry off missions that no one else could, and he was also
expressive missions.
Special forces guy, basically, with paratroopers, and he had a whole team of people with him. Very interesting characters, and he, of course, as many of these people, survived after the Second World War, although I don't think Bandera did, and he went on to be part of this kind of handover between the United States, Great Britain, the Allies, basically, and the Nazis, and he was living, I think it was in Switzerland, I was reading. But anyway, he was a very, very interesting character. What did he have to do with Ukraine back in the war?
He was working with Bandera and his partner Stetsko. I don't know, I can't remember his first name. So they were collaborating together post-World War II, and I'm not sure what kind of, you know, I think they were in some anti-communist activities or something like that. So Scorsese is, he's the real hero that binds all of these organizations together. Like, I mean, they're... the whole not post-World War II neo-Nazi trend, you know, behind, you know, the Black Sun and occult Hitlerism is really, you know, Scorsese is very much a linking personality to all those trends.
There's something a little bit peculiar about all this, and that is that you've got Victoria Nuland, who you say is Jewish, mm-hmm. Having a very close relationship with Nazis. Now, mm-hmm. having studied Martin Bormann and his work in South America after the war, there was a similar kind of thing going on there, where he was setting up companies, I think something like 750 companies in all, and into these companies was laundered much of the Nazi loot from the Second World War through Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm. But he had the wizard idea of putting Jews in charge of these companies so that, you know, that would disguise and camouflage their Jewish nature. So this does seem as if it's a similar kind of thing potentially with Victoria Nuland, is that she's quite happy to work with Nazis. And this, of course, disguises the fact that they are Nazis in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. So it's all very murky. I'm not sure what's going on. So, you know, what's curious is that a key character behind all of this, another satanic Nazi would be Alexander Dugin, who's really the leading personality behind occultism in our time. And he's referred to as Putin's Rasputin. And he was very much the architect of a lot of Russia's recent expansions. So it's a very curious overlaps here. You know, like, I mean, I can't get into all the details, but so Dugin comes from a traditionalist synarchist background, and so him himself again very much into occult Nazism, his mentor was a guy named Jean Parvulescu, and Jean Parvulescu, his mentor was Raymond Abellio. These are, I mean, to tell you how complicated it is, these are guys who contributed to the formulation of the Priory of Zion mythos. Dugin, one of his friends is I think it's Jean-François Thiriard, who is a friend of Luc Jouret, who's one of the founders of the Solar Temple UFO cult that committed suicide in Switzerland and Morin Heights outside of Montreal back in the 80s, I believe. Like so many deep connections. So Raymond Abellio was a friend of Antoine Pinay, who was the founder of the Circle, the Pinay Circle, which is really the umbrella organization of the Fascist International, really the umbrella organization that, you know, held within its reach most of the participants in Gladio. And of course, Gladio was connected to the activities in South America that involved Colonia Dignidad, that was connected to Miguel Serrano. So Parvulescu and Raymond Abellio, they both belong to this organization called GRECE, G-R-E-C-E. I can't remember what the acronym stands for, but it's basically a French far-right organization. The core organization was called the French New Right, the Nouvelle Droite, which is devoted to the study of the Aryan race, particularly. And so an organization that really ties a lot of people together and made up also of people who came from what's called the World Union of National Socialists, which was founded by George Lincoln Rockwell, the founder of the American Nazi Party, as well as, again, Savitri Devi. So you can see that, you know, this is one large fascist international network. And so Putin's key advisor is also probably one of the leading exponents of it.
Okay, but you talk about Russia as the postmodern democracy. Now,
exactly.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So I highly recommend a documentary. First of all, I recommend all of Adam Kurcidas' documentaries. His most recent one is Hypernormalization, and it's a lot about the age of Trump. But what he also covers is one of Dugin's friends. His name is Vladislav Surkov. And so Vladislav Surkov, basically, he has a history of his experience is in postmodern performance theater. And so what Anna Curtis talks about is really fascinating of the kind of theatrics that Surkov was involved in orchestrating in support of Dugin's regime, which they call sort of a postmodern dictatorship. And it's the idea that it's really propaganda for a new age, because it's not about trying to convince people of a particular ideology, but rather to confuse. So really kind of, you know, back to the idea of creating chaos. So he would do things like organize anti-Putin protests, and then he would reveal that he did. And then he'd do simultaneously, he would do the same thing with the right-wing side, just so that people had no idea what was going on. And that's pretty much his strategy. So this is why when you look at the whatever tactics that the Russians are doing, it's their invasion of the Ukraine is a continuation of this kind of postmodern theater, postmodern democracy that guys like Dugin and Surkov are up to. So it's pretty convoluted, I think. And I think it's really important to, you know, not to fall into any sides here. I think a lot of people, you know, are hoping groups like NATO or CIA are going to get exposed. And yes, they've had a dirty hand in this, but there's no clean winners here. There's some other I think it's a lot of theatrics, and there's some other, you know, intent or agenda behind it all.
Well, one of the fascinating things that we've dug out in our research the last few weeks since the invasion happened is that there was actually quite a lot of political decisions being made in the Duma in Moscow. And if anything, Putin was trying to push this potential invasion in order to rescue the Lugansk and Donetsk independent republics. He seemed to be trying to push that back to the Duma, saying, look, guys, you know, we can't really do this, and we need another vote. Will you vote again? And there was a lot of actual democratic stuff going on. Quite whether you think that the parties are honestly reflecting public opinion is another question. But Putin seemed to be trying to stave off this invasion until the last minute. It's completely the opposite, in a way, to what is being painted by the West, as he's some sort of maniac, you know, like Emmanuel Goldstein or something, that everyone is as their sort of 2-minute hate campaign against, you know.
That's it.
And and actually, he, if you look at actually what was going on in Russian politics, he seemed to be sort of for the last for the fortnight or so before the invasion, trying to push it away, saying no, we can't really do anything.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on, but you know, the reality is that Russia has been the main source of funding for the growing right in Europe. So that's been the way that you know, Russia has been, that's been sort of their subversive attempts to try to destabilize American influence and NATO.
What about George Soros? I know he pops up in your article as somebody who's actually quite connected, because obviously he's very, very wealthy. He's Jewish. He even admitted to helping the Nazis back in the end of the Second World War when he was a young man. But he's played a role here funding too, hasn't he?
Absolutely. So basically what's been happening is that most NATO's activities have been, then the CIA, they've been using fronts like the I think National Endowment for Democracy, NED, which Victoria Nuland is a part of, and George Soros's Open Society. So, you know, there's two revolutions that the Americans helped to foment in Ukraine. And the first was the Color Revolution, which I think was in 2003, and then the Euromaidan in 2014. So this is typically how the Americans have been carry out their subversions. As you know, this is the same thing they did with the Arab Spring, but they use these NGOs as fronts to do, you know, quote unquote, spreading democracy, but it's really just American imperialism. And so, like I said, one important front would be George Soros's Open Society Foundation. And so this is why you find that particularly in the propaganda. So the way that the Russians were using their fake news in the United States through Facebook to try to promote the election of Trump, the recurring theme was often George Soros. So that's why they made him out to be a demon, because, you know, he was a character that they were pretty concerned with. But, you know, there's a lot of overlap here, and it's really clear. It's really difficult, I think, to understand who's up to what and who's working with whom.
Well, you're doing a pretty good job in trying to untangle some of that, David, I have to say. But what do you have you got any projections for how this might unfold? This is always the crystal ball question, really. Is this likely to be an extremely protracted occupation of Ukraine? I mean, the aims of the Russians they put forward this week are pretty clear. They're saying they want Ukraine to be an independent country that is guaranteed not to become part of NATO. Number one, they also want independence from Kiev for the two breakaway republics of Lugansk and Donetsk, and they want Crimea to be allowed and given permission by Kiev to join the Russian Federation. So they're three pretty clear demands that they seem to be after. I wonder whether you think this is something that can be sorted out within a few weeks or months, or whether it will take longer or spin into something bigger.
So I watched an interview. This was on I can't remember his name. What's the guy, a comedian who used to pretend to be a conservative and now he's got a talk show? He was on with her, Stephen Colbert. He interviewed Julia Yaffe. What's interesting about her is that she's kind of probably the most respected, expert journalist on the situation there. Because what's interesting is that she worked closely with Victoria Nuland. And my belief is that she doesn't let on to it, but I think she was using her cover as a reporter, basically using the cover as a reporter to do intelligence work over there. And so she knows the situation inside and out. And when Stephen asked her, you know, what are the possible outcomes, then he asked her what's the best outcome. And she had come up with a strange answer. She said that the best outcome that she envisions is that Putin will basically establish a puppet government in Ukraine and that will basically be the end of the matter. You know, like not too much ongoing conflict or anything like that. That's what she says she envisions as the best. So I think for her to have been working so closely with the situation, for knowing it so well, I think it shows. I think there's an intention to let this happen is what I think is what's going on.
Well, in the meantime, there seems to be quite a lot of weapons being. I don't know if you've seen the film Zardoz. You know, there's this giant head. It's a John Borman film where there's this giant head kind of floats down and loads of weapons come out of it. Guns come out of it. And it's a sort of set in a primitive kind of world. But you do feel a little bit like this is what the NATO countries are up to. They've been pouring weapons into Ukraine in the hope that it will be a protracted struggle, and also trying to get as many of the men as possible to join up with the Ukrainian army to potentially fight and die against the Russians. But that is a strategy that may or may not work. We shall see. Finally, David, can you just plug your book Ordo Ab Chao again and explain how it might help people to understand what's going on in Ukraine and whether or not it might lead to a much wider war?
Yeah. So, in fact, I'll just make one last mention to tie it all together, because it speaks to what you just mentioned. As I mentioned, one of the most important sources for my recent book was Russ Bellant's Old Nazis and the New Right. And again, really important for understanding what's going on in Ukraine, but it also what he identifies is the fascist side of the conspiracy, tracing it back most importantly to the American Security Council. And the American Security Council, as he describes it, was the heart, what they call the heart of the military industrial complex. And so as I explained in my book, this is really the central thesis of my book, is to show how the if you look at conspiracy personnel, you know, researchers or personalities involved in disseminating, information about the conspiracy, they've all been tied to it one way or the other. And particularly, they've been tied to organizations that are linked to the ESC, because what they've done is that they have used an interpretation of the conspiracy, particularly presenting it as a communist threat, to justify military buildup. So the ASC, basically, it was originally funded by all the major contractors, or a lot of the major contractors. And so this fear of communism, for the average person, is just enough for them to think that, communism is bad. But on a little deeper level, you've got all these organizations like the John Birch Society and so on and so forth, who advance a more conspiratorial side to it. And this is where, the thread that I follow is, you can lead it all the way up to people like Alex Jones. I would also include David Icke. And it's par for the course. This is throughout the century. That's how it's operated. So my latest book, Ordo Ab Chao, which is now at the 6 volumes, it basically traces the entire history of the occult, shows the origins, going back to at least ancient Babylon, to show how these occult ideas survived over the years, who helped perpetrate them, what exactly they contributed to, and then how they've survived into this one century, and how they've been using interpretations of the conspiracy to create sort of a controlled opposition to steer people towards their agenda while naively thinking they're actually fighting it.
Amazing. Well, look, David, I know you are a Muslim too, and much of this ends up with this potential, anyway, Armageddon style situation. We've even seen the Chinese think tanks saying, well, look, we back Russia because otherwise, it's going to be Armageddon. This is what the Chinese think tanks in London have been saying. This word has been being used in civil society, interestingly, not in a religious context anymore. So can you just paint what you see as a kind of Muslim interpretation of how things may end?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that these three religions, three faiths, Judaism, Christianity and Islam, they all share effectively the same sort of basic end time scenario. Right. So you even down to points like Gog and Magog and the return of the lost tribes and the Armageddon, all these things. And these are points that are not missed by the Satanists, by, if I can mention them again, the Luciferians, these satanic organizations. They are very aware of the scenario, and they believe in it as well. But again, they see themselves on the opposite side of it. So they want to accelerate all of these activities. So, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in a sense. You know, if it's happening, it's because people are actively working to bring it about.
Yeah, and I quite like Catherine Austin Fitz's comments on it. It's a war on God, and God's going to win. So ultimately, these guys are on a hiding to nothing. But it's fascinating to untangle what their motivation is. And when we start to see, at least potentially anyway, the mingling of news stories appearing on our TV screens with these things talked about in the Quran and in the Bible, David. So anyway, just remind us of your website finally, please.
Thank you. It's ordoabcao.ca. So David, there's links. My entire book is online in divided six chapters as web pages on my site. You'll also find links to the both print version and Kindle version on Amazon.
Okay, David Livingston, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thanks again, Tony.